Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Box Spot for this Monday, May 23rd. I'm Alan Chartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from New York Oncology Hematology for over 30 years, providing comprehensive treatment of cancer and blood disorders, world-class care close to home, newyorkoncology.com. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Prathima Kanumori. She's a board-certified breast cancer surgeon with Ellis Medicine in Schenectady, specializing in surgical treatment of both benign and malignant diseases of the breast. She's here to answer your questions. It's going to be a popular program, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Kanumori, your calls and much more all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. One of six police officers charged in connection with the arrest and death of Freddie Gray has been acquitted. In the bench trial of Edward Nero, the judge said the prosecution had failed to prove that the officer intended for a crime to occur. Nero faced the lightest charges. He was on the scene when Gray was arrested and was charged with actions leading to Gray's initial detention. NPR's Ada Peralta has more.
This is the second trial. The first one of Officer William Porter ended up in a mistrial, and he was charged with involuntary manslaughter. And the prosecution still has the trial of Caesar Goodson to go, and he is charged with second-degree murder. Officer Edward Nero was charged with all misdemeanors, so this was in some ways the sort of low-hanging fruit here.
NPR's Ada Peralta. Prosecutors say Freddie Gray suffered a broken neck while he was in a police van. He died a week later. His case sparked days of protests in Baltimore over police treatment of young black men. The U.S. Supreme Court has thrown out a death sentence of an all-white jury in Georgia handed to a black man who was convicted of killing a white woman. By a vote of 7-1, the justices ruled that prosecutors improperly kept blacks off the jury in the trial of Timothy Tyrone Foster. After spending 29 years on death row, the outcome may enable Foster to get a new trial. Austrians narrowly elected a retired economics professor backed by the leftist Green Party as their new president over an anti-immigrant populist from a far-right party. More from Joanna Kakissis.
The president-elect is Alexander von der Bellen, a 72-year-old chain-smoking economist. He defeated 45-year-old Norbert Hofer of the Freedom Party by just over 31,000 votes. Hofer, who trained as an airplane mechanic, talked tough on migrants, especially Muslims. His party's anti-migrant message struck a chord with Austrians. Many are concerned that this small country of fewer than 9 million cannot support the 90,000 asylum seekers who arrived last year.
Joanna Kakissis reporting. European pharmaceutical company Bayer is making a $62 billion offer for American agricultural giant Monsanto of St. Louis. St. Louis Public Radio's Wayne Pratt has more.
The German company announced the dollar figure in a release issued today. Bayer says a combination would bring together its crop protection technology with Monsanto's expertise in seeds and help create a global agricultural leader. Monsanto has not commented on today's announcement, but revealed last week that its board is reviewing an unsolicited offer, but says, quote, there is no assurance that any deal will be entered into or consummated. The St. Louis-headquartered company failed to acquire Switzerland-based Syngenta last year. Monsanto has also been cutting costs. It reduced its global workforce over the past year by about 16%. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Pratt in St. Louis.
This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Chevrolet, with the all-new 2016 Chevrolet Malibu, offering available teen driver technology with a feature that can limit the maximum volume of the music so drivers focus on the road, not the radio. Learn more at Chevy.com.
Support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering a Master of Social Work degree, full-time, part-time, day, evening, weekend options, online, in-person, hybrid courses. Adelphi.edu for more information. The hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, healthquest.org for locations. And from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, announcing their updated website with more information about membership, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org.
This is WAMC Regional News. I'm Jessica Blaustein Marshall. In the headlines, a new coalition of community organizations, faith groups, and labor unions says New York can address government corruption by tightening campaign finance rules while making it easier to vote. Calling itself Demand Democracy, the alliance includes the State Council of Churches, Communications Workers of America, the Working Families Party, the New York Public Interest Research Group, and others. Today, the group proposed several changes to election laws and ethics rules, including broad online voter registration, greater income disclosure rules for lawmakers, publicly funded elections, and lower campaign contribution limits. The suggestions come after the previous Assembly Speaker and Senate leader were sentenced to federal prison this month for unrelated corruption charges. Lawmakers plan to adjourn the 2016 session next month. Following last week's four-alarm fire underneath Metro North Railroad's Park Avenue Viaduct in New York City that resulted in a few days of significant commuting delays, a New York State senator from the Hudson Valley has introduced legislation that calls for the review of elevated tracks. More from WAMC's Allison Dunn.
Republican Senator Terrence Murphy's bill directs the Metropolitan Transportation Authority to study and report on potentially hazardous structures and storage areas under elevated train tracks, as well as study and report on the commuter notification system. New York City fire officials say it was fuel spilled onto a generator that sparked the blaze at a garden center under the tracks in East Harlem. The fire did not cause any damage to Metro North's tracks, signals, or third rail power system. Murphy says his bill is about safety, and that a number of propane tanks also were found beneath the tracks. I'm Allison Dunn, WAMC News.
Republican Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey has rejected legislation that overhauls the powerful Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Christie today conditionally vetoed the measure passed by the Democrat-led legislature in April. Christie says the legislation would insulate union members from Inspector General fraud investigations and require costly engineering audits for capital projects over $500 million. Instead, Christie is recommending that lawmakers adopt a bill similar to one already enacted in New York and proposed in New Jersey by Senate Republican leader Tom Keene Jr. Democratic lawmakers called the veto disappointing. It's unclear whether lawmakers will take up Christie's recommendations. All lanes of I-90 West east of Exit 12 are reopened at this hour. The left lane was closed today after a structure fell from a truck in Rensselaer County. According to New York State Police and the State Department of Transportation, troopers were on the scene. The structure was wrapped in white packaging and bared the words "oversized load" on its side. The Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation is seeking to find and eliminate potential sources of water pollution in the White River watershed. The two-year study will focus on non-stormwater discharges into stormwater systems in 12 Vermont towns, including Bethel, Chelsea, Randolph, and Hartford. The Valley News reports the department has contracted Burlington-based Watershed Consulting Associates, LLC, to do the work. On Wall Street, a short time ago, the Dow was up 37 points at 17,538. The Nasdaq was up 10 at 4,779. Meteorologist Jason Caterina says today mostly sunny with a chance of scattered afternoon shower or a thunderstorm, highs in the 70s to near 80. Tonight, mostly cloudy, scattered showers, lows in the 40s to low to mid-50s. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, chance of showers, highs in the 60s to low 70s. I'm Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Stay tuned for more WAMC News coming up after Vox Pop at 3.
Support comes from Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans with weekly tastings. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins, grapesandgrainswine.com. The digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond, noinkyfingers.com. The Pride Center of the Capital Region and TD Bank presenting annual Pride 5K run at the Corning Preserve boat launch, June 5th from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., capitalpridecenter.org. And from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials. 518-432-0358.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. We're joined today by Dr. Prathima Kanumori. She's a breast surgeon with Ellis Medicine. She specializes in surgical treatment of both benign and malignant diseases of the breast, a branch of surgery that has seen dramatic changes in the last decade, including disfiguring aggressive surgical approaches in favor of breast conservation. Dr. Kanumori earned her medical degree in India from one of the top colleges there, medical school. She completed her residency in general surgery at Bay State Medical Center in Springfield. Pardon me. She also completed fellowships in aesthetic breast surgery and minimally invasive surgery at Northern Western Hospital, Yale University School of Medicine, and North Shore Long Island Jewish Medical Center. She's certified by the American Board of Surgery. Dr. Kanumori, thanks for being here.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
Well, I'm good. So tell me, let's just start out very quickly. The line should be filling up. 1-800-323. No, that's wrong. 1-800-348-2551. Okay. Boy, I must be tired or something. Okay. Doctor, how has breast surgery changed?
Breast surgery has really come a long way in the last 20 to 25 years. I think one of the biggest, there's been huge advances in all the multidisciplinary approach in treating breast cancer. I mean, I can speak really in regards to breast surgery itself, where in the Halstedian times, people were really having very aggressive surgery, where they would remove the entire breast, ribs, and really all the lymph nodes in the axilla. People had very disfiguring surgeries, and I think reconstruction was not even something that was considered. But now we are really understanding that really people's outcomes really depends on not the extent of surgery, but really the biology of the tumor. So our understanding has really changed. So we've been able to really do more minimal surgery with having the same outcomes. And I think this has helped women live more complete and better quality life.
So we also know a lot more about genetics than we did before.
Yes.
Should women be screened for the various trouble signs?
So only 10% of breast cancers are because of genetic causes. Most breast cancers are usually happens sporadically, and there's really no clear reason as to what the cause of the cancer is.
Really?
So definitely there should be certain signs that it should prompt one to really look for a genetic cause for breast cancer. For example, women being affected by breast cancer at a young age in their 30s, 40s, and probably early 50s. The most common time to really be diagnosed with breast cancer in average woman is in the 50s and 60s. So if patients really are diagnosed at a much younger age, if there's a lot of family history, like on their, multiple, their first degree relatives, like their mother, their grandparents, their own children, and also their extended second-degree relatives, then we should really be looking into having further genetic testing. But the various parts in the family history and personal history that really prompt us to look for these for patients who could be affected due to genetic reasons.
So we've given too much hype to the genetic thing, you think?
It is not true. I think there's definitely needs further understanding. I mean, we've really found a lot of genes that could be associated with it, and we've been able to really save a lot of families in really identifying this gene and probably looking into early intervention and other and discuss various prophylactic options. But I think the key to really, I think there's more, genetic genes to be found that really can be causing breast cancer. We've only identified some, but if there's definitely, enough family history to prompt it and we find this, we can definitely make an effectively save lives in these situations. So I definitely don't think it's a hype, but we have to screen them appropriately.
So what's on the burner?
for.
In other words, what can we expect in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think we're going to be expecting a tremendous amount of research in the medical oncology field. I think that's where the advances are happening in really trying to tailor breast cancer treatment to a very personalized approach. I think that's really where we're heading. And I think that's where all the energy is being focused on triple negative breast cancers. And
what does that mean?
There's certain features of... We actually look for specific receptors in breast cancer cells that really help us tailor targeted therapy to treat the breast cancer cells specifically and not really give therapies that could be harmful to all cells. You really target just the breast cancer cells. So for this reason, extensive research has been done to find these various targets on these cancer cells. So far we look for something called, at this point, the three receptors we routinely look for in breast cancer cells, estrogen receptors, progesterone receptors, and HER2 receptors. And if these are present, we actually give targeted therapy specifically to those cancer cells based on these receptors. But if all three were absent, then we don't have specific targets in these patients, and the only treatment they can get is like the chemotherapy, which can be very, a more intense treatment. So I think these cancers who are triple negative, we're still trying to find very good targets for them.
Okay, we'll take a call. Let's go to line 1, 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, caller. Hi, Dean. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Are you there?
Hello?
Hello. Can you hear us?
Yes. Hi, Alan.
Good.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I didn't realize I was the first caller. This is somewhat unrelated, but it is tied in. I have a good friend that I'm trying to help out. She has one of the worst cases of fibrocystic breast disease the doctors in this area have ever seen. She's had cysts removed and drained. Her annual scans for cancer are basically almost useless because the breast tissue is so compromised. She's also been advised to get a breast reduction due to the usual problems from that. She's also had a cervical fusion, which may be related to that as well. And what we're confused about is, if you want a great aesthetic outcome, usually they say go to a plastic surgeon. Otherwise, you're dealing with a cancer specialist. And, we would like a nice aesthetic outcome, but we want somebody who can handle the difficult structure that they're going to be dealing with once they do the surgery. So can the doctor help me try to figure out how to find a surgeon that could help with that for the best sort of outcome?
Hi, Dean. I'm Dr. Kanamori. Thank you for calling us with this question today.
Did all that make sense or not?
No, it made perfect sense. Obviously, unfortunately, my heart goes out to your friend because it's a tough situation to be dealing with. And they're not very common, but when they are there, it's very, very, it really affects their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
So is she seeing a breast surgeon at this point?
Oh, yeah. She's seen 2 or 3 different ones. And
okay.
They've advised her to get a reduction. And usually they're recommending a plastic surgeon.
No, I think that's appropriate. I think, because she has like fluid disease everywhere, I really think it's not like we're really worried about a specific problem where, let's say, if it's a surgical oncologist is absolutely necessary, if you're dealing with the cancer and then, also trying to do oncoplastics along with it. So it's very important they're actually present during the case to make sure that the plastic surgeon is really abiding by all the oncologists. Logical principles. In this situation, when it's primarily a benign situation, the key is actually, getting appropriate imaging. And with her, it's been a little tough. I completely understand. But I think, to work with a breast surgeon, but then she can have surgery with a plastic surgeon, but long-term follow-up for her cystic disease would still be with the breast surgeon.
Yeah. And they've been following her for years. You get nervous with all those TV shows on nowadays where there's two doctors on now and in Beverly Hills that are repairing butcher jobs that other surgeons have done. And when you look online, there's a tremendous variation, and I know it's related to each patient, but there's a tremendous variation in the quality of what you're going to find. So how do you find a really good plastic surgeon to, that would have the ability to deal with this sort of situation? She's gone from a C to a J, so that's what she's dealing with.
Okay. And it's mainly because of the cysts in her
No,
breast?
It's just, that's just...
Okay.
As she's gotten older.
You know, this is the thing. You know, ultimately, there's going to be some, I think it's good to get the names in the community and what your insurance offers and do some research through patient forms to see what their experience has been. And pick somebody who's been in the community and practicing for 10 years or so, so that you know enough about them. And then I think, you know, mostly these are not very complicated surgery, but she might still have complications because of her medical condition.
Right, that's what I was concerned about.
But I think, you know, the principles of doing reductions are routinely done, and she should be okay.
So, Dean, we have to take a break. I thank you for your call. Very interesting. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dr. Chartok. I appreciate it. Thanks, Doctor. Oh,
absolutely.
We have lots of free lines, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back to take your calls.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, working to create a culture that helps nurses professionally and personally. EllisNurses.org for more information. Oakwood Friends School, Poughkeepsie, an independent college preparatory boarding and day school for grades 6 through 12, dedicated to creating a dynamic community of learners since 1796. OakwoodFriends.org. Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's, and eczema. UVA and UVB sun protection. ProtexGloves.com. The Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for information. And from Audubon Service, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, offering service, repair, and diagnosis of Asian-made and imports, specializing in late-model Volkswagen, Subaru, Audi, and BMW, AudubonTechnic.com.
So, what is the number one concern that women who come to see you, doctor, is?
So the first concern, the most common concern that every woman comes with, like any type of breast symptom, it could be pain, it could be just a small lump, or it could just be a little redness. The first thing they're like, do I have cancer? I think that's the first concern that every patient has. And a lot of my discussion with the patient is to reassure them that majority of the time, breast cancer is really not associated with a lot of symptoms. So a lot of times I'm really helping them feel comfortable with the fact that that's not what we're dealing with. I think that's the most common concern.
I was fascinated by this last call because I've known people with cysts. You have to take each of these cysts seriously, right? Because you don't know. No, you don't.
No. So cysts are usually, the most common cause of a cyst is usually a benign reason. So breast kind of makes cysts, and usually in your 40s, your breasts start involuting in the sense that they've kind of done the primary function of, childbearing age, and a lot of time breasts involute. So fibrocystic disease is very common in patients in their 40s and 50s, and some patients are more prone to it than others. So I think when a cyst is persistent, or a cyst has bloody fluid, or a cyst is something called a complicated cyst, where it has like a lot of, it looks like there's something else within a cyst, like a little growth in a cyst or anything like that, we worry more because we want to make sure it's not cancer. But majority of cysts are usually benign.
Yes, but how do you know? Those criteria you just gave us.
Yes.
I mean, how do you know until you take the necessary pictures and everything else.
Yeah. So basically, the way it, so women at their 40s will be having screening. If they see something suspicious, they will have an ultrasound. So necessary imaging will really have a look at what, you know, the cyst. If they actually have a palpable area, then you get the appropriate imaging and you're able to tell it's a cyst or a mass. And then once you diagnose that them with a cyst, then you can have to critically look at the cyst and kind of see, is it a simple cyst? Is it a complex cyst? And kind of like how, you know, over time we've collected this data as far as based on the radiological findings, we decide they look worrisome versus not, and we follow them up based on those. And if the person is symptomatic, then we'd actually aspirate the cyst. And if it's a bloody, if it's bloody or it's persistent or is associated with a growth inside the cyst, then we have to pursue it further.
Huh. Let's go to Dick in Long Meadow. Okay, Dick in Long Meadow, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We're seeing some of these new drugs. They're called they're immuno-oncology drugs. They really aren't chemotherapeutic agents. And right now, the FDA has indicated them for lung cancer. Do you see any possibility for any of these immuno-oncology drugs to be used for breast cancer in the future?
We actually use targeted therapy right now, currently, which has been extremely effective. It's called Herceptin. And we have another drug called Perjeta that's out in the market. So these are actually targeted therapies. They actually target HER2 receptors, which can be present in about 20 to 30% of breast cancers. And prior to discovery of these drugs, patients with HER2 positive disease, cancers with HER2, which were HER2 receptor positive, actually did more poorly. Those cancers tended to be very aggressive. But after the discovery of these drugs, we've seen some tremendous improvement in outcomes. So we already use those kind of drugs in breast cancer, and they've been very effective. And we're only going to find more and more targets. And that's kind of the goal of how the research is really being geared at this point.
That's good. Thank you for answering my question.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Okay. And now we will go to Ted in Ulster. All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ted in Ulster, you're on.
Yeah. Hi, doctors. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I've seen a lot of evidence on YouTube about this black salve cure. It seems unbelievable.
You know, actually, I'll have to Google it. I have no idea, honestly.
Okay, it's really bizarre. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye now.
Yeah. We get a lot of calls here, doctor, by people. Don't feel badly about this, that people who talk about various cures that they come up with in some places, and then few have heard about them, but you never know. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent with Dr. Kanabori. 1-800-348-2551. So, doctor, I guess I'm wondering what your experience has been, having been trained in both India and the United States, in terms of American medicine versus Indian medicine. Are we at a place that is much better, much worse? What can you tell us?
I definitely think America has, the health system is definitely more organized, more patient focused. And I think the key thing is really the organized, it is extremely organized compared to what's going on in India. But we're really in the process of trying to make very advanced changes. Like, for example, 20 years ago, there was no health insurance. There was, medicine was primarily given in government sector run by the, there was really no medical research going on. And like in India, we probably don't even, compared to America, the number of dollars that are spent on healthcare by the government is very low because primarily people, pay for their own healthcare. So all of that is actually, I think India is trying to emulate some of the Western systems where we are now. Health insurance is available. Companies need to provide insurance for patients. And I think, in the past, past, there was also not as much of like patient really being really directing their own care, which was not happening in the past. It was very much like the doctor was the god and he kind of told you what to do. I think all of that is changing with the internet and being available, with the literacy rates going up and the social media. I think patients are more have a better understanding of their conditions, and all of that is also improving healthcare, so things are changing in India for the better.
We will go to Carrie in Ulster. Okay, Carrie, you're on. Hello, Carrie.
Hello.
Hi, Carrie. This is Dr. Kanamori here.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, my father was had a very rare form of bladder cancer.
Okay.
And he's like the 14th documented case in America. And they took out his bladder. It was a tumor, and they said it was blood-based, so like carcinoma. And they wanted to treat him with chemo and a booster, for in case there's still some in his blood. And I just wanted to know if there was anything else or something new that could be done, you know, other than what they're doing.
Well, now, Dr. Kanamori is an expert in breast cancer, and not in others. Although you may want to take a crack
in other areas. I'm sorry. I just tuned in, and I'm sorry. So, thank you for being there, and have a lovely day.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Laura in Albany. All right, Laura, you're on.
Hi. I'm a local family doctor, and I wanted to just mention that women in New York State can still get free mammograms from the state, and then if anything is found on it, ultrasounds are given, and all the follow-up treatment for free. So just to remind people not to hesitate to get screened, even if they don't have insurance, because the Healthy Women Partnership still pays for that.
So, Laura, where should you go to get this?
Google free mammograms New York State, and I think it'll come up. It's called the Healthy Women Partnership.
Doctor.
And then the second thing is, I know about what that black salve treatment was because a patient brought it to my attention. And fascinatingly, this woman who apparently is widely followed claims to have had breast cancer, and she used this black salve and it cured it. But if you read her website carefully, there was never a biopsy. There was never a pathologic, you know, examination of anything in her breast. And there was never a diagnosis of cancer other than in her own head. So possibly she had a bad abscess, and with hot packing it and putting salve on it, it resolved. But it's very fascinating because patients brought this, like, oh, what about this treatment for my cancer? And when I read through it, she actually never had the diagnosis of cancer.
Well, Dr. Laura,
thank you so much. I was actually starting to just look it up, and I've never actually seen. I mean, I should never undermine a treatment without knowing much about it, but I've never really seen a patient do very well with non-allopathic, you know, remedies for cancer in general.
Okay.
I think they tend to be aggressive. But,
thank you, Laura.
Thank you so
You're
much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll go to John in Beacon. All right, John in Beacon.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I wondered if the doctor could speak a little bit about the role of nutrition in breast cancer and whether or not there have been any significant studies in the past, ongoing or that are planned, anything that's come up in those, or, you know, any relevant areas of research that look promising.
Hi, John. So there's been a lot of research, and there's still ongoing research on that, but they've never really found like this one particular type of food that's going to really make a huge difference. The most important thing that I think that all of us should always, you know, remember is there's been a strong association with obesity and increased risk of breast cancer, and also outcomes in patients with a larger BMI. So I think that's important information that we should all know, that just generally being healthy, being at an acceptable BMI, exercising regularly. I mean, also there's been also some studies that say that people did much better when they exercised regularly. Even I don't remember the exact amount of number of hours per week, but there's always there has been a benefit with physical activity as far as outcomes in breast cancer. So overall, sticking to eating healthy, you know, antioxidants, and like really, I think the key is to maintain a good BMI.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any studies that have compared, for instance, Eastern medicine diet versus Western?
I'm sure they are. I don't know any on top of my head right now. I don't have a specific study. But, you know, there's a very common question that a lot of people ask me, and I don't think there's a clear answer on this, is the use of soy and how that can, does it increase your chance of having breast cancer? And I don't think there's ever been a proven, you know, a study that proved that it actually makes a difference, because, you know, in Eastern countries, actually breast cancer is probably a little lesser. It's changing. I think in the urban setting, it is increasing, but they eat more soy than us. So I don't think there's a very clear, you know, no specific, you know, certain type of food that really is a benefit or not. I don't think there's anything proven at this
point. John from Beacon, thank you for the call. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Franny in Rensselaer. Okay, Franny, you're on.
Hi. You spoke about cysts and being common more in older women over 40. My question is about women who are younger, in their 20s, especially with a family history of a grandmother with breast cancer at 30, a cousin with breast cancer at 30. Could you talk about that a little bit? What and is there a relationship between cysts and stress? What causes cysts?
So like I said, you know, certain people make more cysts. It's not, it's just a part of, you know, certain people's breast tissue and how it behaves. And some people make more than others. Not everybody has cysts, but people who make cysts tend to make more cysts. Is there a very direct connection between people who make cysts and breast cancer? Not necessarily. There's been no real connection between the two. And like I said, it's not necessarily that having a cyst, it's a type of cyst and the features of the cyst that sometimes increases a person of, you know, having an associated cancer along with it. But cysts itself don't increase your risk for cancer. If that answered your question, I...
So how would you know, if she often has cysts, how would she know when it's a serious cyst as opposed to a, oh, this is just another...
So this is the thing. So if the way you really go about screening, I would, anytime it gets a little confusing, you kind of fall back on what the general recommendations are. So the general recommendations, we still, you know, I know there's been a lot of data out there about the time to start screening. So at 40 is where routinely most people recommend yearly screening. And if you have a family member who was affected at a young age, you want to start screening, you know, about 10 years prior to when they were diagnosed. So that's as far as looking for cancer. As far as cyst, if she feels something abnormal, she should have her is assessed by her, you know, OB, and then they should do the appropriate imaging and kind of decipher what they're dealing with, a cyst or a mass, or, and maybe she's someone who should have more, you know, frequent clinical breast examinations. But I would stick with what the general recommendations are, and the cyst shouldn't be a reason for her to start screening early or anything else.
Franny, thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Urological Institute of Community Care Physicians, a team of four uro-oncologists with 75 years of combined experience providing advanced robotic surgery for kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer. UrologyOncology.com. Fatigan's Nursery, Latham, New York, featuring herbs and veggies, perennials, flowering shrubs and trees, organic soils, and gardening guidance. Independent since 1920, Fatigans.com. Saratoga Hospital, committed to women's health with the Saratoga Midwifery and Women's Primary Care Practice at Exit 13 of the Northway, saratogahospital.org. Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, presenting indie rock quartet Luna in concert on May 28th, and The National with Yasu on June 11th, massmocha.org. And from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com.
We're back, and we're very interested in having you call. But right now, don't try it, because all the phones are busy. We've got a Ruth in Albany. Ruth in Albany, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about the discussion the surgeon has with a patient after surgery. I have metastatic breast cancer. After my lumpectomy, my surgeon discussed with me the possibility of a recurrence, either in the same breast or another breast, but never discussed with me the possibility of metastatic activity. I wondered whether the doctor does that with her patients.
So, we always do talk about the various treatments, and, you know, we do mention that. I mean, I don't know if we specifically emphasize so much on the metastatic part. We just talk about the various outcomes based on the surgery, and a part of that is distant metastases also. We do discuss that, but the emphasis is on the treatment at that time. And I definitely will keep your concern in mind, and really keep that in mind when I talk to my patients.
Thank you. It's given that 30% of us will get metastatic breast cancer, it's kind of important to talk about it so we can catch it early and maybe get the best available treatment at the time. Can't do anything to stop it, but at least help.
Did your medical oncologist mention that to you at all when they had discussed?
No, nope, not until I metastasized.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Appreciate it. Okay. We'll go to Suzanne in Kerhogson. All right, Suzanne, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, and about a year later, I found a lump. And, you know, had it examined and went to a consultation with a breast specialist, and she determined that it wasn't cancerous, but I got a DNA test at the time to assess my increased risks, and it turned out that I was slightly over the increased risk, and she wanted me, because of that, to see a medical oncologist for chemo preventative for risk reduction, and I'm just unsure. I mean, if it's not cancerous, then why would I have chemotherapy?
So, no, I think the word, I think, always throws you off a bit. So the fact, I mean, the reason we mention chemo prevention is more really to have a discussion and really understand what's out there. So when somebody has a risk that is higher than the average population, so we always kind of have this discussion with the patient as far as screening and as far as what preventative measures you can take. And one of that is actually, there have been studies out there for breast cancer prevention, and that is using tamoxifen, which is also used for treatment purposes in patients who actually have breast cancer that is estrogen receptor positive. But in those studies, they also found that taking anti-estrogen medication for 5 years might decrease your risk by 50%. So the way we look at it is we give that information to the patient, depending if you have a very strong family history, you have a lot of risk factors that increases your risk to much higher extent than the average patient, then maybe you can decrease that risk partially, or at least by 50%. So we just kind of refer you to a medical oncologist. And as far as having to take the medication or not is a personal choice.
I see. So it's not like chemotherapy in the traditional sense of...
No. It's the word chemo... It's a chemo prevention, really.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you.
All right, we'll go to Betsy. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Betsy in Woodstock. All right, there you go, Betsy. You're on.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I just had a double mastectomy on November 17th. The cancer was in my left breast, but I opted to take both breasts off. Mm-hmm. Since then, my doctor has recommended, and this is related to the last call, really, anastrozole. Mm-hmm. I'm taking 1 milligram every day, and I mm-hmm. wanted to know, you do recommend that kind of therapy, right?
So it's very difficult for me to tell you, like, what to recommend or not, because, you know, everybody's cancer is different, and your doctor is going to suggest the treatments necessary based on the biology of your tumor and the various features of your tumor, which is very difficult for me to comment on. You know,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm. I understand.
Yeah. But did you have invasive cancer or in situ?
Actually, it was stage one and it was under my left nipple.
Yeah.
And they took one of my lymph nodes and that was negative.
Yeah.
But I still said I don't want to fool around with it. And I had both breasts taken off. I'm an old lady. So.
No, absolutely. And if you had invasive cancer, routinely they do. I mean, I don't mean to talk about your cancer because I don't know exactly all the details of it. But routinely, even if a patient had stage one disease and they had a mastectomy, once they have invasive cancer, there's always a potential that microscopic cells could have gone to other parts of your body. So the standard treatment is to recommend antiestrogen therapy if you are ER positive cancer. So that would if you had invasive cancer, we would recommend that normally.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it made me kind of sick the first couple months, but now I'm getting used to it, and I'm just going to try to stay on it forever.
And it's basically kind of preventing the distant metastases, like the other person was talking about a couple of calls ago, is really to prevent these microscopic cells to go make home in other parts of your body and essentially cause distant metastatic disease, maybe not in your breasts, but in other parts of your body.
Well, thank you. Are you seeing more and more women opting for a bilateral?
That's kind of the national trend, but, you know, and I think we are struggling with that because I don't think that is kind of, there's no evidence that really supports bilateral mastectomies. At this point, unless they're the genetic predisposition, there's never been any studies that actually say that having, you know, a full mastectomy or a contralateral, the opposite side, just for prophylaxis, mm-hmm. really having a survival benefit, provided you don't have an abnormal gene that increases your risk for breast cancer.
Well, I'm comfortable with my decision, and I feel great.
No, absolutely, and you're absolutely right. It is your personal choice, and that I think that's fantastic, and I'm glad you're doing really
Betsy
well.
Betsy from Woodstock, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, let's go to Michelle in Beacon. We're getting a lot of calls from Beacon today. Okay, Michelle in Beacon, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Shark Talk, I'm a huge fan of yours. I love your work. Thank you. And
thank
I have
you.
A question for the doctor from India. Is there any growing interest in the use of low-dose naltrexone in the treatment of breast cancer?
I am not aware of it personally. Unfortunately, I haven't read much on this particular drug. No, I'm not aware.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot of information on the internet, and I've just wanted to
I'll definitely look it up. Thank
from
you.
A doctor.
Thanks
thank
a lot,
you.
Michelle. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to Linda in Pittsfield. Linda in Pittsfield, you're on.
Hello, doctor. I'm a three-time breast cancer survivor. I had breast cancer in 2008. I had breast cancer in 2009. And then in 2012, I had a third breast cancer, and they finally decided to do a mastectomy with reconstruction at the same time. Unfortunately, I couldn't just have implants because they said I had had too much radiation.
Yes.
So they decided to take my stomach and bring it up through, I don't know, my chest and make two breasts with my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Since For 2 years now, I have been in agony. I have gone back. In the meantime, I was having chemotherapy, and while I was trying to recuperate from this double mastectomy and reconstruction, and I was just wondering if you have any suggestions on what I can do. I went back in. He loosened the mesh. It didn't help.
This is the abdominal portion of your...
This would be... He actually loosened it wherever they put the mesh when they make two breasts. I'm not sure where that is. I think he did. He loosened it on the top and not on the bottom.
So they took tissue from your abdomen?
Yes.
Okay.
They used tissue from my abdomen and made two breasts.
Yeah.
And I have been in agony ever since. I have tried acupuncture. I have tried, you know, exercise. I have tried numerous things. And I want to know, number one, can I actually have these breasts removed, or is it impossible now that the tissue has grown up around the mesh and it's impossible? Because I'm at that point where I can't stand it any longer.
You're having pain in your breast area or in your abdomen?
It's not pain. It feels like I walk around with a 10-pound weight on my chest, and a tightness around just underneath the breast and just above the scar near my navel.
Yeah. You know, it's a very, I mean, obviously you've had a very complicated oncology course as well as a surgical reconstruction course. And I'm really sorry about your experience. See, absolutely. I don't know exactly the scenario because obviously I don't know you for a long time and I don't know all your reports. But as far as can we remove the breast after reconstruction? Absolutely. Because it's really, that breast is really there for cosmesis purposes. And if but is that removal going to change the pain and everything that you have? That is going to be something that you're never going to know, for sure. And
the question was, is it, first of all, they made me huge, huge breasts, and I was never a huge, huge breast lady. So I have these huge breasts that, I think when I hold them up, that it does alleviate a little bit on the top, but the waist where around the middle is very, very, very tight.
Yeah. You're absolutely, you know, can you make them smaller? Yes, you can. Can you remove them? Yes, you
will
can.
Will that change anything?
See, the problem is nobody's going to be able to predict. And they cannot guarantee, and that's the sad part of it. We want to know absolutes, but unfortunately, there are no absolutes. It's something that you can try, but we don't know for sure.
Linda, thank you.
Okay, one other question, Doctor. Is there anyone that you know of who has had this kind of an operation, not implants, but where they've taken someone's stomach and tissue and made two breasts?
Yes.
Is there someone else I can talk to who maybe has dealt with it in a different way that I could maybe learn something from?
I don't know specifically, but I would, you know, normally most tertiary hospitals do this type of surgery. You can kind of get a consult from another local, another hospital in the area, tertiary care hospital, and you can probably talk to another consultant. But I'm not a plastic surgeon, and it's kind of difficult for me to guide you in this area.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Linda. Okay, we'll go to Essie in Wingdale. Okay, Essie in Wingdale, you're on. Essie. Hello? Well, Essie was on, but not anymore. Okay, let's go to Christy and North Adams, and we do have a couple of phone calls we can take. 1-800-348-2551. All right, Christy and North Adams, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling to see if the doctor has heard of anything new in the range of treatments for triple negative cancer. I'm 16 years out from my first one and 4 years out from my second one. And I haven't found anything in the literature, but maybe you have.
So,
and doctor, before you proceed, perhaps you could tell everybody here what triple negative means.
triple negative breast cancer, like I was mentioning in the beginning of the show, it's basically we take cancer cells and really assess them for various receptors. And the common receptors that breast cancers have in them are estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2/neu receptor. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of trying to discover more receptors and have more specific targeted therapy. So when somebody has all three receptors are negative, they're called triple negative breast cancers, where we don't have specific targeted therapy, they get general chemotherapy. As you mentioned, Christy, there's really, when you've been diagnosed with cancer 4 years ago, there's nothing that, as far as I know, there's nothing that can be really done at this point that is new. But I think when somebody is affected by breast cancer, I think there's a lot of current trials open at more, you know, tertiary care centers, at research centers, where you can really probably learn more about newer drugs kind of being available. But one of the new drugs that we use platinum-based chemotherapy is a common thing that we're trying to look into for triple-negative breast cancers at the time of diagnosis.
Yeah. And right now I'm fine, but triple-negative cancer loves to come back. So I thank you very much. I will see what I can find in the line of chemical trials.
Yes.
Or clinical trials. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay. So, Doc, let me ask you this. When a patient has to decide on what to do and cancer is discovered, are they better off going to New York City or Boston or staying here?
Breast cancer treatment is, we have very good treatments, and I think most of those treatments are available in the areas that you are. I mean, if you're really in a place that there's really, you know, there's no medical care, that's one thing. But in this area, we have very good specialists that really offer all the treatments. The people who should really be looking into going to you know, to other, you know, Dana-Farber or Sloan, are really patients who are really have a very rare type of breast cancer, or somebody who's really, you know, very young and an unusual situation that they should really look into what are the current trials available, or patients who have recurrent disease, have had the standard treatment, which actually in breast cancer is extremely effective, and now they have a recurrence and they've really tried all the regular drugs and now need to look into more research options. So those are the patients who are really going to benefit from going. But otherwise, for standard breast cancer treatment, which is extremely effective, I think we have very good, you know, facilities here to be able to provide that.
So what about trials? I mean, you know, you got to go. There are those who say, well, if you got to, you know, Cornell in New York or to Bay State, you have a better chance.
So, like I said, it all depends on the type of breast cancer you have and the situation. And like I said, like breast cancer, we've really made great advances that we have really excellent treatments available. And for most patients, majority of patients are going to do well with the standard regimens that have been proven to be very beneficial. I think there's always going to be rare types of cancer, rare situations with like recurrent disease or patients, and those are the patients who should really, you know, consider clinical trials. And also, you can always get a second opinion, but if you're getting the same exact treatment there or here, then you're always better off getting treatment close to home, because it's the most stressful time of your life and you really don't want to be removed from your place of comfort.
Thank you for that. We're out of time, but I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to those left on the line. I'd also like to thank Dr. Prathima Kanamori for joining us today. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from Nathan Letower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Letower, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures, NLH.org. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.